coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody. Chris Jordan here, coming at you live tonight. Hope everybody is ready for the amazing holiday coming up, the annual gorging feast that is the American Thanksgiving. I'm not going to lie. I mean, I know that there is a bloody, bloody history to Thanksgiving. There's a bloody history to a lot of holidays. But I enjoy Thanksgiving, mainly because I love cooking. It is one of my favorite things in the world. My family was like, what can we do? I'm like, sit there, watch me cook. That's what you can do. Like, I don't care, but I'm handling this thing. I love cooking, so Thanksgiving is one of my favorites. I hope everybody is doing well. Thank you all so much for your support. Last week, we got some great reviews, some great stuff from our coverage at Stairway to the Stars. We met so many great people. We had so many returning guests that were there. Randomly ran into Brad Olson. Hey, old buddy. We were there actively helping our friend Kathleen Ball. She gave a great couple of presentations on the Knights Templar in Brazil while we were there. We had Steve Bassett was back on the show while we were there. We met Ronnie LeBlanc. He's a wicked cool guy. All kinds of fun stuff. It was a great, great show. We had about 5.5 hours of coverage, so it's nice to be back live. I love the live stuff. Not that I don't love covering things out on location. That kind of, it is an amazing opportunity and an amazing experience to really dive hip deep into communities around the country. But man, sitting here at my desk, having the conversations like we are having tonight, the second part of the show after commercial break, we'll be joined by our good friend, Dennis Stone from America's Stonehenge. If you live in the Northeast, if you visit the Northeast and have never been, it is in Salem, New Hampshire. It is one of the most enigmatic and just fantastic sites that I have ever had honor to visit. And to know Dennis on the level that I do now is wicked cool, to be able to get the VIP tour and go behind the scenes and see things that aren't necessarily publicly accessible all the time. It's an amazing, amazing site with some amazing archaeological history that we will be getting into with him. Everything from astro-archaeological alignments to histories of local natives that were like, hey, that was here when we got here. We have no idea what it was used for. So really cool stuff coming up after the break. In the first segment, our good friend and guest, Dr. John Hall. He is the author of Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control, as well as Satellite Weapons, New Breed. Welcome back to the show, Dr. John Hall. How are you doing?
Hey, Chris. Been a long time. How have you been?
Oh, doing okay, man. Been a little like crammed just before the holidays. Everything just kind of like snowballed, as opposed to like normally my industry, there's like, it kind of like eases into a lull this time of year, you know? It's been slammed. It's been good, but been harried. So how you been doing, man? How's the new book coming? How's all the new research?
Good. New book is coming along. Just trying to get the finishing touches on that and, you know, trying to get the government to leave me alone enough to get it put out. And of course, I kind of figured I was going to be hearing from you once we had another shooter, you know, turn up in Maine. I heard from a lot of media that wanted to have me on after that happened. So.
Well, whenever that happens, doctor, especially whenever it deals with military folk, the first thing that always comes to mind is how we first came to know each other, which was the Aaron Alexis shooting at the Navy Yard many years ago, 2012 now. I believe that was. And there were a lot of markers there where, you know, he just, much like the gentleman who was just an off-roader and owned an off-road business, who just randomly went down the tube of violence, you know? And it was very much the same way with this main shooter, where he was okay, he was all right, and then suddenly his last stint going to the Army National Guard, he was hospitalized for hearing voices, things like that.
And I think what troubles me, it's funny that you mentioned that we kind of came to know each other during the Aaron Alexis shooting of the Navy Yard, which is true. That was in 2012. But you would think, you know, we've had so many other shootings after that, and almost all of these people have claimed mind control or admitted to hearing voices or admitted to having a military background that they thought had something to do with it. And you would think that just once a major media source would say, you know what, every one of these shooters is hearing voices. Maybe this isn't mental illness. Maybe this is something else. You know, maybe we should look into ways that somebody can make somebody hear voices in their head or hear voices around them that they think are in their head. But you notice the major media won't go down that road. You know, it stands to reason. If something keeps happening, that you look for some reasons other than just turnkey, call it mental illness. Oh, another person went crazy, grabbed a gun, and started shooting. You know, in the only part of the voices that you hear, and, you know, especially when some of these people have left manifestos saying that they're being mind controlled and giving the examples of the stalking and everything else that came with it, you would think that just once, you know, a major media source would say, you know what, maybe there's something more to this. Maybe this is technology that's meant to mimic mental illness.
Well, and you know, even on that same note, aside from military people, man, that same year was the woman in D.C., the single mother, who ended up being shot by the single Secret Service after going past barricades, making a crazed U-turn. She ended up being killed by the Secret Service right there in front of the White House. But come to find out, she thought that Obama was stalking her and heard the voice of Obama in her head, all kinds of things. So there was another one that was just utter civilian that was a prime example of the same thing, you know?
Well, I mean, two others that are of note were, there was the guy in Alaska that went to the FBI and said, you know, I'm an Iraqi war vet. You know, I feel like I'm being targeted. You know, I'm hearing voices. They're asking me to do things that, you know I shouldn't do. And I'm asking for help, and the FBI sent him back out. They said, no, you know, there's nothing wrong with you. We can't help you. You know, maybe see a psychiatrist, but, you know, we're not going to detain you. And then he flew to Florida and tried to shoot at the airport there before he was shot dead.
Yep.
And then you had Myron May, that was an attorney. I think had been the attorney general in New Mexico, at a city in New Mexico, that went and shot up a college in Florida, I think, before he was shot dead, and left a manifesto saying that it was that, you know, he was doing it not because he wanted to kill anybody, but because that in his mind, the only thing that was going to garner any media attention to the problem was to do something so bad that the media would pay attention. Well, of course, you know, the error of his thinking was that, you know, they were going to see it as targeting. Well, they still saw it as, you know, the rantings of a crazy person.
Well, and that's just it. And I've got an article from NBC News up about him saying, you know, he believed government stalkers were harassing him, using a, quote, direct energy weapon to hurt him. And, you know, I have had numerous conversations with numerous people, even to the point of like virtual reality scenarios being projected to them, doctor. And one question that we had before we did this, I put out a slide on numerous social media platforms. Like, if you're a targeted individual and have a question, feel free to dial in. And we did have a couple of responses. One of them was from a good gentleman that listens regularly whenever you're on in Arizona. He wanted to ask, how does a person who is being targeted find a doctor? How do they find somebody? I mean, most of the population doesn't even know about Havana syndrome, which is the closest thing that is diagnosed, that is close to what people claim as far as directed energy weapon injuries, brain fog, regular confusion in their life, to the point of once again hearing voices, to the point of madness with some of them.
Well, and just so you know, some of those, you know, the people that are the true Havana syndrome victims, for the most part, have had a gag order on. That's why you have it. Yeah. It was a 60 minutes interview. There was a couple of other interviews, and that was about it.
The one that you see is the CIA officer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who has been fully briefed, who has been fully debriefed, and who, though, is coming out and saying things, guaranteed is saying things in an approved fashion.
Yeah, well,
otherwise he wouldn't be let's just say he wouldn't be getting you know, medical disability or anything like that if he was out spouting things that he wasn't allowed to spout.
Yeah. Well, and then the point I want to make for, you know, listeners too with that is that as much as the public may not want to believe that there are directed energy weapons that can be, that are neurologic based weapons that are directed at the neurologic system of human beings, the UPenn people who actually did most of the research on the diplomatic victims of this technology came up with just that it was directed energy, that it was probably microwave based energy. You know, despite some of the well-known microwave energy experts who for years have told us that there's no way to modulate microwave energy where it can be used as a weapon without causing heat in the tissues. And that's also turned out to not be true. And you have to be careful with, you know, some of the experts that you listen to and I'm not going to name names, but some of those experts derive their income from government grants.
And,
yeah,
I mean,
and you know who I'm talking about without, and most people that are probably listening know who I'm talking about without mentioning names. But but if most of your income comes from government grants and you're working for through government agencies doing their research, then you may come out and kind of talk about, you know, how the brain has no firewall and that we do have weapons that can kind of do this. But they won't go as far as saying that those weapons are being used experimentally on the American public.
Yeah.
Now, as far as the question that the listener had, finding a doctor is hard because, you know, certainly I encourage everybody that's being victimized by this, make sure you have a physician for the stuff that you really need a physician for. Now, in all reality, you know, your average general practitioner, or, you know, somebody that you're going to, while you definitely need them to treat some medical illnesses, they're still not going to know, even if they believe you on this, they're not going to know how to help you. And they are still going to say, well, maybe you should see a psychologist or a psychiatrist just to rule out any mental illness, unless there's somebody that has heard about it. Now, I will say, you know, 20 years ago when I started writing about this, just writing about it, you were considered crazy. You know,
lost your medical license, man.
No, yeah. When my first book came out, you know, my attorney even, you know, he said, this is crazy because I've never heard of this. Most people have never heard of this. I don't necessarily believe that this technology exists, and you're probably going to lose your license for writing this book. And so that's why when people go, well, do you really believe this? I risked my career on this, you know, I know it exists. I've talked to CIA agents that used it, talked to NSA agents that used it. I have those connections. Yes, it exists. It's been worked on for a lot of years. And, you know, the sad part is, and people don't want to believe it, you know, is there technology where they can hear your thoughts in real time? Yes, there is.
I've actively got up right now an article from Caltech. This is, let's see, June 2021. So pretty modern, right here. Recording brain activity with laser light. quite literally talking about a new process where they can record your brainwave patterns and everything else by just shining a laser light on your scalp. Simple as that. That is pretty easy and passive technology, man. When you're talking about the ease with which they could mass swath brain waves from people to find out average brain waves in an area, things like that, average states of mind in an area, that's kind of disturbing.
Well, and one of the examples that I give in a lot of my talks and when I lecture at places is I'll ask people, I say, have you ever had one of those days where you get up in the morning and, you know, you're well rested, you had a good night's rest, but you get up in the morning and you go to work and you're not 100%. You don't feel like being there. You don't feel like being at work. It's a blah day. It's not that it's raining or it's overcast. It may be perfectly fine weather-wise, but you still kind of sit there and you know you're not going to be 100%, not one single part of the day. You know, and it's what I call just a blah, exasperating day. And then when you start talking to people, everybody else feels that same way. You know, there's nobody in the office that's like, you know, Mr. or Miss Chipper that day that just can't wait to do their job. You talk to everybody's kind of like, yeah, this is just, man, just feel like, don't even feel like being here. Just didn't even feel like getting out of bed. And everybody kind of feels that way. Well, I don't think that may be necessarily circumstance on a lot of days. I think the control is such that you can control individuals or you can control communities. And that would make a lot more sense because ultimately it's been working on controlling the public for a long time and not just using this kind of technology, using media, using, you know, the Nudge Squad. If people remember that when Obama was in, he started the Nudge Squad that was going to get online and try to nudge the direction of belief in, you know, one direction or another on certain topics.
And hey, until crickets started driving people crazy in Cuba, Doctor, this was all myth. The government would never admit that we had sonic weapons. They would never admit that sonic weapons were a thing. They would never admit that they were researching into it, anything like that. Same thing.
Well,
that they were saying about, like, oh, hypersonic weapons are decades down the road. You know, decades down the road. Yeah, you know, they were out loud and proud about things like LRAD and stuff like that, non-lethals for the battlefield, that kind of stuff. But when it came to the micro-miniaturization of those things, like the Chinese sonic weapon, you know, the size of an average rifle that can vibrate your brain and give you Havana syndrome type injuries, that kind of stuff, they didn't really cop to that until Havana syndrome hit the headlines.
Well, and if you remember, I mean, you and one other, you know, media person that I'm a frequent, you know, guest with actually kind of broke that, you know, at the same time.
Yeah.
And if you remember when that initially came out, the government that had the talking point they gave to the media was acoustic weapon.
Yep.
They said, well, we think it's some type of an acoustic weapon and, you know, we're really not making too much of it. And I remember on your show and this other show, I said, it's not an acoustic weapon. These people were all indoors and that's a line of sight weapon. And I remember, you know, saying, talking to both of you and saying, this is going to be microwave energy. Well, and of course, then the next thing that came out, Psychology Today, you know, with detractors posted an article saying that it was mass hysteria, you know, mass psychosis, you know, from stress, which is what the CIA kind of hung their hat on with Congress. You know, when the even after the researchers at UPenn said these people have brain damage, you know, they were the victims of some type of microwave trauma to their neurologic systems, and we can prove that they have brain damage. Even then, the CIA still went in front of Congress and said, well, you know, we can't really, you know, we back that up, you know, with our own research. We think it's stress related, and have kind of stuck with that, you know. And the same thing with the Canadian victims, their government kind of turned on them as well, even though there was a promise that they're going to work with these victims and try to come to a realization of what really happened. But my favorite is when when nobody bought the Psychology Today article that it was mass hysteria,
yeah.
then they blamed it on permethrin being sprayed for crickets. Now, anybody that knows anything about insecticides, I mean, you know, I'm a farm boy, you know,
yeah.
and, you know, so, I mean, I've stood in the fields when the crop dusters are spraying the fields, you know, I've bathed in the poison when it's coming out the airplanes. And, permethrin we use for a lot of different things, and it's a kitchen safe poison for the most part. If permethrin was going to make us hear voices, we would all be hearing voices.
Yeah, because yeah, like every country kid out there using that in their front lawn to keep fleas away from their animals would be hearing voices.
Oh, if you go to the store and you're going to buy an insecticide, any one of those cans, you know, Raid, Hot Shot, whatever you buy,
yeah.
I guarantee you most of it is permethrin.
Yeah.
Because that's about the only one that's legally, you know, left to buy.
Well, and the one that got me and still does, and if you're a targeted individual out there, I know that we have quite a few that are listening right now as we speak. If you hop on over to curiousrealm.com/knowledge/studies. Right there is probably one of the most insulting things to all of this, which is the Hall Effect study, which once again was a group of doctors who never even contacted you about your work, never even followed up with the fact that everything that your books is based on is based on, much like what I show on the show, where it's like, I'd love to say they're hitting a patent out there, but here's the patent, you know?
Yeah.
You had to go through government means to get this book published, because of the technologies that you were talking about. Yet still these doctors decided to go through and make a study talking about how, this effect of people and targeted individuals specifically is much like mass hallucinations of hauntings, that all of these people are delusional and are experiencing what equates to a mass hallucination that has come around because of your work.
Yeah, and I wasn't real sure whether to be mad that they published that without actually contacting me. You know, because every bit of that study and those claims are based on my two books,
yeah.
you know, and listening to some of my interviews. But you would have thought before they were going to put something like that, they would have tried to contact me to talk to me about it. But no such thing.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if I should be flattered that the truth is so important to the people who want to detract it as well, that they're willing to put out counter intel, you know, to respond to the truth, which is exactly what that is. You know,
yeah.
that's to try to convince the everyday listener that, but even that, it's kind of failed, because this technology is in such rampant use in the community and in our society now that almost everybody knows somebody that's complained of this. Now, you know, they may not believe it, and it may think that it's all BS or that it is mental illness across the board. But I guarantee you, if you talk to just about everybody and you mention this technology, they're going to go, yeah, I've read something about that. Or I've got a friend who says that's happening to him. Or I've got a son or a daughter that says that's happening to him. I mean, it's affecting just about everybody now.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, once again, I have had people tell me about little holographic images, almost to the point of like VR, like virtual reality, almost being taken mentally into another space. And when you start talking about things like MIT communicating with dreamers, not just being able to like, hey, look, did you see an ad for Coca? Did you see something that looked like a Coca-Cola ad? Cool. It wasn't just that. To the point of call and response, doctor, to the point of actively being able to ask a dreamer a question and that dreamer being able to answer it while they are in dream state. Amazing things are happening with this technology. And to know that some of it may be nefariously routed, nefariously used. We did have one call if you give me just a second, I will cue that up and we will hear the story of this young man who's been going through some things. We can talk about a couple of the things he talks about that are common markers amongst targeted individuals. Here's that call right now, Doctor.
I have been targeted my whole life. I could go through everything, but I'll just say some of the highlights. I was mind controlled as a kid. I was degraded a lot. As a teenager, they would sabotage me sexually. The big attack started when I was 19, just starting college and stuff. They would make me have the fear of God and make me incredibly paranoid and act really strange around my friends and family. I went to try to get help. We thought I had schizophrenia. So I was trying to get help through medically, and eventually I went homeless from more sabotage. I did not graduate college because they would attack me during work and school, and they did another set of heavy attacks from the year 2019 to present. They started hacking me a lot. They would make me feel pain and torture from the signal that they have on me. They would, they've been sleep depriving me lately. They got me fired from jobs all my life and made me get into car accidents all my life. So I'm ruined financially. Let's see. They started V2K around 2020, and I'm still hearing them to this day. There's a lot of sabotage, a lot of degradation, a lot of attacks I've suffered throughout my whole life.
So once again, that is an all too common story when it comes to targeted individuals, when it comes to those that have suffered these things, specifically the degradation, the turning of society against people, is what gets me more than anything. The way that once these things happen, it's almost like everybody at once turns on them.
And that's how it's geared to work. I mean, they designed it to mimic mental illness for a reason, because for the most part, psychiatry is used punitively in this country. You know, not condemning the entire profession, because certainly there's a need, but as a physician point of view, looking at it, if you look at most of the way psychiatry is used, at least by the government, is used punitively. You know, if you look in the military, you know, if you've got somebody that has pissed off a senior, you know, person, and they're up for promotion and you want to keep that promotion from happening, you accuse them of mental illness. You know, you send them to a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist knows that their job is to give them a diagnosis. And once that diagnosis is given, that person kind of craters. And it's the same thing with targeted individuals. The ultimate goal of the targeting is that you complain to your family or you complain to your physician. You know, usually there's a mandated psychiatric evaluation. You put all of your data, you put a copy of my book and all of your Google research in front of, you put your list of patents in front of the psychiatrist. Here's the five or six different ways that, you know, of technology that have been proven to be able to put, you know, voices in or around you, so it sounds like you're hearing voices when nobody else can. There's multiple technologies that will do that. And the psychiatrist says, yeah, but there's no reason they'd be using it on you. So you're psychotic. You know, if you're young enough, it's schizophrenia. You know, if you're in your 40s, which most of these targeted individuals notice it happening, you know, late 30s, early 40s. They're a little too old to be diagnosed as schizophrenic. So they end up with a diagnosis of psychosis.
Yeah.
And most of these people, when you talk to them, if they really did a thorough interview, they can tell you the day the stalking started. They can give you plate numbers for the stalkers. And like in the girl that I wrote about in my first book in San Antonio, all of those plate numbers came back to the same private investigative group that was owned by a former FBI guy and his son, who was a former lieutenant colonel in the DOD. So, I mean, if somebody would really invest in a really good history with most of these people, I think a lot of these psychiatrists would see that, you know, maybe there's a little something more to this than mental illness. And that's where the media really kind of comes in too. If major media would step in and say, man, every one of these shooters are hearing voices, you know, is it that they're all on SSRIs or are they being targeted by something else? Hey, the government really wants gun control. Is there a way that the government could be creating these controlled assassins in order to get gun control? Let's look at that angle.
They won't blame SSRIs because then they would have to openly admit that they have no idea how the hell an SSRI works for one person and doesn't work for the next with the exact same symptomology.
Yep.
Like half of what I do is medical conferences, and the number of those meetings that I've sat in from various manufacturers, things like that, you know, where it's like, I wish that, like, we know they work, but no different than other kids in my elementary were put on Ritalin when they were a kid, worked bangers for them. They put me on Ritalin, and about 3 weeks later called my mom and said, we need to get him off because we can't keep him awake. Like, it looped me 180 degrees. You know, I was one that had the totally opposite reaction. Like, it really slowed me down, you know? So it's strange because we don't know how all of those work. But when it comes to microwave weaponry, like the document I've been showing on screen here, the effects of radiation and bio effects of selected non-lethal weapons is the name of the declassified document. This came out in 2006. And quite literally, this chapter right here, clearly the effects of microwaves on brain tissue chemistry and functions are complex and selective. It starts going into body weight, things like that. But the part that I've highlighted right now, a similar type of effect was observed with exposure to a, quote, resonance-tuned, end quote, extremely low-frequency magnetic field. Thus, the database is replete with phenomenological observations of biological systems, quote, affected by exposure to electromagnetic energy. And the sentence just before that is, recent published data implicates microwaves as factors related to a deficit in spatial memory function. So, like, yeah. Yeah, like we know good and well what the effects of microwave weaponry are.
Well, and what my favorite line in that study, the selected bio effects of directed energy weapons, and you're right, that was declassified and then reclassified.
Yeah.
You know, and it was declassified long enough for me to use it in my first book, but and then it went back into classification. Yeah, and which, by the way, at the same time, both of my books became unpurchasable on government computers, too. But my favorite line in that article, actually, is when they said, imagine the disturbing effects on an enemy combatant when they begin to hear voices in their head that they know are not their own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And even right here, biological target normal functions disease states, you know. Like, they are calling it target. They are saying that that the intent of this study was what is the probabilities if we use this technology as a weapon. This was a phenomenological study done on the viability of a weapon. Pretty much. So it, once again, to say these things don't exist, to say over and over again completely that people who say that they exist are crazy, that even the, and once again, when I had the NBC article up a while ago about those that were targeted with Havana syndrome, there were right there. There it is, still highlighted. About 1,000 people have reported symptoms, the subtitle says. 1,000 people reporting symptoms. And that article was, you know, 2022. So as of 2022, we know of at least 1,000 people that have reported symptoms to the federal government. And those are federal employees, things like that. That went all the way from Cuba to China to Russia to Washington, D.C., people mm-hmm. being targeted.
And that's why a lot of targeted individuals that contact me all say, well, you know, we want to contact the FBI. You know, the FBI will help us, or the UN, you know, will help us. You know, we all need to petition the UN, you know, with a grievance. And, you know, if you look logically at what the end game is to this technology, it's to control the public. And, you know, especially currently the movers within our government, and at least within both of our major parties, you know, both have a globalist bent, and they want a globalist government. And our intel agencies have kind of, you know, picked themselves to be the strong arm of that globalist government. So ultimately the technology is meant to control us all, you know, and as evil as that sounds and Orwellian as that sounds, with this technology, it can be done.
Well,
you know, I mean,
it doesn't take much. And that's what we say on the show all the time. Whenever we have you on, whenever we have Mike Turber on, you know, much like it, people think that you would have to convince the whole country for there to be a revolution. Less than 20% of America took place in the American Revolution. The rest of everybody was standing on the sidelines going, hey, man, hey, stop that. You're a crazy person, you know. So much like to get hearings happening in Washington about UFO UAP, it didn't take 100%. It took 20-30% of people going, whoa, 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 funding what? Hold on. What secret program that I didn't know about and I'm on the committee? Hold on. You know, and much like this right now, there is a bill going on that prevents spying on American citizens, things like that, that is going out there. And hopefully that will prevent at least some of the use of frequency ranges as far as targeting in areas, things like that. But yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned the UFO hearings, and that's kind of another little pet peeve of mine that I've had for years now, is that I can go on a radio show, a syndicated radio show, or go to a university and speak, and I can stand up there and give the most outlandish reports of, you know, the time I've spent with the Greys or reptilians that I've communicated with, or that, you know, I've walked around and, you know, saw Bigfoot.
That's a totally different episode, Doctor.
Yeah. Well, but you know, the point I want to make is that people won't bat an eye at that. The government won't bat an eye at that. Some of these big syndicated radio shows won't bat an eye at that. They're, UFOs probably exist. You know, you think about it, it's a big galaxy. There's, you know, they're probably out there. You know, Bigfoot, you know, it was in the 1900s we discovered the gorilla. So, yeah, gorilla, you know, Bigfoot, maybe Bigfoot could probably exist. And I said, well, let's talk about mind control technology. Oh, you know, that, now you're into tinfoil hat territory. You know, now you're talking about, you know, the mind's too complex. You know, why would the government want to control your mind? Most people don't amount to anything. Why would you want to control them? You know, no, and on and on and on, you know, and the media just absolutely won't cover it. I mean, you know, I'm into, you know, film production as well. And we've been trying to get a film done on targeting that's not a documentary, an actual docudrama entertainment type film that tells the story of targeting. Man, it is, you can't even get a production house to meet with you on that topic.
Yeah.
I mean, the last movie that came out, really, that kind of broached was probably Enemy of the State. And there was one other that I think was called Targeting that kind of came close, that was about a woman who volunteered to be chipped and controlled by AI for a while, and it went bad. But I mean, as far as a legitimate docudrama about targeting, nobody's interested in it. I mean, we've got the scripts, we've got the people willing to do it. Can't find any production people, you know, willing to invest in it, because they know the government's going to shut it down. Some of the targeted individuals probably remember Discovery Channel actually, you know, came to me and wanted to do a series on targeting. And we got about three episodes done when the government said, yeah, you're not going to show that here. I mean, there's, I think, one or two episodes called United States of Paranoia. You can find that they put on Discovery in Europe, in Finland or
Discovery
somewhere.
Discovery UK.
Yeah.
Came out on. And it was there and gone, much like there was an ill-fated series here in the States called Going Off Grid. And it was a guy who was a security professional, and literally, like, the whole premise of the show was, all right, so it's time for you to disappear. Like, there was one episode that was put out, and I mean, he goes through the fact of, like, so we're going to start posting on social media, like, 3 weeks before, how we can't wait for the upcoming cruise to Alaska. It's going to be great. It's going to be awesome. And the whole time, you're not going to Alaska. You're, like, taking a train somewhere else, you know. And you go, leave your phone at the docks, you know, and let it sit there and take off somewhere else without a phone. Like, it was truly like how to vanish yourself from society was the first episode. And it lasted exactly one episode because it was way too real, man. Way too real, and way too, like, you know, if you follow things on SVU, you may be able to get away with a crime or two for a little while, you know, because there are some actual methods inside of there. And that, I think, was the same issue with the series that you're talking about. There were way too many methods that are even just public knowledge that could be outed. To real public knowledge, you know, beyond the point of digging for a PDF like we've done, you know.
Well, and then looking for, when you're looking at the chances of any of the major media outlets giving a fair shake to targeting, I can kind of tell you a little bit of history of where that's gone. If you remember, the New York Times actually did an article that they contacted me on, and mm-hmm. were like, no, I talked to them before we interviewed with them, and I said, yeah, this needs a fair shake, because there's something going on in this country and globally with technology that's causing this. Oh, no, we're going to give it a fair shake. Well, you know, they basically used a broad brush to paint everybody that's complaining of this as mentally ill, said that essentially microwave weaponry wasn't at a state where it could be used as a weapon or be used in a technological means of this fashion, and basically labeled me as a Pied Piper for the mentally ill, claiming to be targeted. Well, then it wasn't 10 years down the road that when the diplomats came forward, and some of them, you know, weren't just hearing, you know, buzzing or chirping in their ears, they were hearing voices as well. And then the New York Times came out with, when early on, when the UPenn researchers said, this looks like it's microwave hearing or microwave attack. Then they came out and with an article saying, oh, my God, you know, the diplomats are being attacked with microwave energy that can put voices in their heads and, you know, cause sounds in the brain and voice to skull and completely change their tune. But then when the CIA stepped in and said, well, you know, no, we're going to call this anxiety, or we're going to call it crickets, or we're going to call it permethrin. And then there was even, well, it's two different forms of technology. It's our counter intel technology that's interfering with possible Russian surveillance technology that's creating a hybrid beam that may be causing it. And well, then they were quick to jump on the fact that, well, you know, maybe it's not microwave energy. So, you know, it's difficult to get a fair shake for, you know, this type of scenario when there's hundreds of thousands of people being victimized by it, but you can't get a major media source to actually give it a fair shake, because most of the major media sources do kind of follow the New York Times, as wrong as they are on just about everything. I mean, the New York Times is one of the most quoted and repeated sources of news that you'll see online.
It's definitely one of the news leads out there, you know. As you know, as my listeners know, I follow a mad number of RSS feeds. Like, if you follow the Curious Realm group, That's pretty much all it is RSS feeds of news being posted. And yeah, the New York Times will typically be one of the first sources out there with the story. Because next to the New York Post, they're one of the goldest games out there, you know? And yeah, they definitely have their slant for things, most definitely. But they have been the proud home of headlines like Black Money, UFOs, things like that. There's been some great stuff by Leslie Keen. I'd love to see someone like her get a hold of this topic and really start tearing into that. Because once again, I think until we do get media behind this, because it wasn't until Lou Elizondo came on CNN and said, hey, check out these videos. We recorded these a long time ago. It wasn't until then that conversation, even in the media, was okay, you know, and that pretty much came through the New York Times once again. So I think getting media involved and behind this topic is hugely important. And if anything, to outing the technology, I am one of those. If we can look at the elephant in bite-sized chunks and which ones are the juiciest ones to start with, let's start with the actuality of the technology. You know, because much like you were saying, like Bigfoot, Sasquatch, things like that, if you went to them with the story on that, they would at least gladly entertain the story as a story, you know. But when people find out and see the trail of evidence, there is a massive amount of technology that does this. You know, and literally does put voices in people's heads to the extent of there was just the recent study done, doctor, where they reconstructed a Pink Floyd song from people's memories. Like staggering, basically had them come into a lab, listen to a Pink Floyd song, then days later, put them under MRI. With other technologies and said, okay, now think about the song, and reconstructed it from their memories. Pretty amazing. But that is the realm of technology that we are currently dealing with. And that's just the stuff that we hear about in the news that does interesting, sexy science. You know, so much of this is unsexy science that never sees the light of day when it comes to a headline.
Well, and you know, the rule of thumb they say is if you're hearing it on the news, it already exists, and it's about 100 years in the future better than what you're hearing. So you know, and you know, another story that I don't know if you caught that I was asked about on another radio show was, again, New York Times article that Business Insider and several others, you know, kind of, you know, rebroadcast, but was a group of artillery soldiers in Iraq during when they were fighting ISIS. You know, one of the ways they defeated ISIS was to limit the number of bombs being dropped by airplanes, was to drop some bombs from airplanes, kind of, you know, get them corralled into one area, and then just shell them with artillery day and night. And these are guys that were with these artillery, you know, companies, you know, were, you know, miles away from any of the fighting. So they, you know, they weren't face to face with any enemy, but they were subjected to artillery blasts from their cannons going off, you know, for, you know, 24/7 for, you know, months while they were doing artillery. Well, a lot of these guys came back and started reporting hauntings. Several of them were seeing ghosts. A bunch of them committed suicide. And it turns out that as the VA did studies, they found out that even though they labeled it PTSD, but what was just being in the vicinity of these blasts caused a similar injuries to what we see with microwave energy in the diplomats, caused white matter tract damage. And these people started, you know, having hallucinations, auditory and visual, and, you know, seeing ghosts and committing suicide. And when I saw that article, I knew I was going to, you know, get some calls because it sounds eerily like targeting.
Yeah.
And then you have to wonder, is this an organic way of simulating targeting? Is it, you know, maybe the government's way of introducing a red herring as an excuse for targeting?
Yeah.
Or is it experimentation?
That has been quite a bit of the conversation in the thread tonight is, you know, it being used as a red flag.
Yeah.
And most definitely, especially whenever you're using it to push a selected populace, whenever you, because there has definitely been the research done into how you can drive a populace. It started back in the days of MK Ultra, and let's see what happens to this whole small town whenever we, you know, put some LSD in some bread at the local bakery. Like they had numerous experiments to see how they could go through and control the mind on a mass scale. A huge one was Edgewood. The Edgewood experiments that basically the movie Jacob's Ladder was based on. It was an LSD derivative that was used as an inhalant that put people into crazed psychotic episodes. And the idea was to, how can we en masse basically intoxicate and disable our enemies in the field? And yeah, we did mass experiments on soldiers right here in America during that.
Well, that's why when I saw the article about the artillery shell things, and then you got a question, are they really looking at the effects of a blast? Or is this a group of soldiers that's being targeted by electromagnetic weaponry? You know, or is it truly something that organic that is happening that needs to be addressed? The troubling thing is that the VA told all these guys that they really didn't have a way to diagnose micro injury, because if you do MRIs on these brains, they're normal. You know, normal 3T MRI shows a normal finding. And then just like it does in targeted individuals, and just like it did on the individuals, the diplomats that were, you know, complaining of Havana syndrome, what they wound up having to do is called diffusion tensor imaging, DTI. Mm. And that actually shows white tract damage. But the troubling thing with these soldiers that were suffering from artillery blast, allegedly, that were seeing ghosts and hearing voices, they were told that there wasn't a way to diagnose it and no known treatment, and that the VA was really only used to dealing with macro trauma, which is, you're being shot in the head, or, you know, having a, you know, shrapnel to the head, that, you know, that trauma that's visual trauma to the brain, not invisible trauma to the brain. And when I saw that, I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, we can diagnose micro trauma through DTI. And, I'm in the personal injury business with motor vehicle accidents. A lot of times you'll have a hit to the head that's not severe enough to cause macro trauma. You know, you don't have a big blood clot on the brain or bruising to brain tissue. You know, you have an MRI that looks normal, but then when you do diffusion tensor imaging, you'll see that there is a disturbance in certain tracts of the brain. And if you EEG those tracts where the damage is, the EEG is abnormal in those areas too. And it can be treated with transcranial, you know, magnetic stimulation, and pretty successfully treated that way. So that's one of the things that I've, you know, kind of been, you know, kind of loosely trying to think about doing, is getting a group of civilian targeted individuals, not just diplomat targeted individuals, together to do a mass amount of diffusion tensor imaging. So we'll have that science there showing that, yes, this type of energy blast to the brain you know, that while you're using it to target someone is also causing brain damage that we can actually show scientifically.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I've got numerous abstracts and articles up right now talking about electroencephalographic activity caused by multiple extremely low-frequency field exposures, you know, things like that. And the fact that exposures to RF fields absolutely change the EEG of people. And the fact that, yes, if you can do that, that means you can absolutely do that in the opposite as well, like you've said, in guinea pigs, like you said, in satellite terrorism, the fact of being able to heterodyne somebody's EEG signal, to be able to pick up their brain waves at a distance, the same way that they're doing with this laser technology that they're talking about in that Caltech article that I brought up at the beginning of the episode. So it's pretty wild technology to see that we have that it's out there, that it's actively being used. And it's one of those that you really do have to be able to put that fractal puzzle together and see the fact that all of these kind of add up to exactly what people have been talking about.
Well, and I don't see this getting any better anytime soon. You know, as you know, I'm a political animal too. And, you know, a lot of complaints on my second book were that it was a little too political. But, and I'll tell you the reason that it is, and we've talked about this before on your show, is that a lot of the people that are targeted by this, they focus their time and energy on figuring out a way to block it or figuring out a way to counter it. And certainly that's, you know, certainly one of the things you should do. And we have figured out some things that can kind of help, you know, with it. But, you know, when the government has invested billions and billions of dollars into this technology,
yeah,
it's going to take billions and billions of dollars to figure out how to counteract it too. And that's just beyond the expense of, you know, a group of civilian targeted individuals. Therefore, the answer has to be political.
Yeah.
And the answer is going to be getting, you know, compassionate enough leaders and legislators in there that are going to listen and say, you know what, there needs to be oversight, you know, on the intelligence agencies. Right now, there is none. You know, and I'll tell you who made that clear as day when Trump was in office and Schumer said that the intel agencies have six ways to Sunday to get you back if you piss them off. That should have told everybody in the nation exactly what they need to know.
Yeah.
So that basically our leaders are somewhat scared of the intel agencies and kind of kowtowed. I mean, if you look at our current FBI director, congressional hearings, he answers the questions he wants to and doesn't answer the ones he doesn't want to.
Yep.
And he knows that there's nothing that's going to be done. Well, so, you know, and until we can change our DOJ and change our political system and get some compassionate and, you know, true leadership, you know, in there that's thinking in terms of what's best for the American people, not enriching themselves, then, you know, we're kind of doomed.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, yes. Yes, politics can be slow to change. However, things can also happen in rapid windfall fashion. You know, even to see the fact that once again there is the new bill coming up for stopping of spying and invasive information on the American public by intelligence agencies. That in and of itself helps lay groundwork for these things. You know, and much like whenever you tune into a congressional UFO UAP hearing, don't expect them to wheel out a gurney with something underneath a cloth. Don't expect them to wheel out a wheelbarrow full of wreckage. You know, what you can expect is things like Grush saying that there has been a multi-decade obfuscation of trillions of dollars of money since the 1930s for reverse engineering of technology. Now, what you have there, whether the claims of people seeing bodies are true, whether the claims of people being part of reverse engineering programs are true or not, what you have is somebody going before Congress and saying, when I went to ask these questions of these contracting companies, your employees, government, they slammed the door in my face. So now you have an actual trail of investigation. And once you follow that trail of dark black money, you can find out who's slamming doors in people's faces, you know. But it took some interested parties to get a group together and go, okay, hold on, you know, and to start having these open-minded discussions. And I think that, you know, despite what a lot of people think about folks like AOC, stuff like that, she is full on, full front in so many of these groups that are spearheading these things. You know, and I am glad to see bipartisan things coming out. I am glad to see bipartisan things being proffered on all of these disclosure topics, because we have to be willing to have, if we aren't willing to have the conversation that the technology exists, then yeah, we have no means by which to rein in and control the technology as the people funding the technology. That's kind of silly. Like
that's kind of what we've been asking for years, is just, you know, congressional hearing, you know, kind of similar to what we've had on UFOs. I mean, trust me, there's plenty of people. The closest we had to it was the Bioethics Commission that Obama, you know, called for, you know, after they had to apologize to the Guatemalans for being experimented on, which was Hillary Clinton as his, you know, State Department person that offered that apology. And then they called together a bioethics commission. I actually went and spoke along with several other physicians that, you know, were against this technology at that bioethics commission. And at the end of the day, they said that there was no evidence that there was any experimentation by the government going on the public. So, you know, and the person that headed up that bioethics commission went on to also head up the Penn Biden association. So, you know, there. So, it's going to take, you're right, just a continuum of good people trying to do the right thing.
Yep.
And hoping eventually you win over the years that can put it in play in front of Congress. So,
for those of you out there that have been brave enough to tune in tonight, contact your local congressman. Tell them your story. Let them know that much like those thousands of now government employees that have come forth and said, I have had these symptoms, I have had this. Let them know that you as a civilian have had this and that you are concerned. Because once again, they may not even know that things like this are going on in their backyard, much like human trafficking, things like that, targeting of individuals like this, the gang stalking, things like that, are things that are happening right there in your backyard, people. It's pretty phenomenal to stop and think about, and it is pretty mind-numbing to stop and think about. Just in the time that I've known you, Doctor, and become a part of this community in the way that I have, the stories that I have heard from people, the emails that I've gotten from people with stories like what the gentleman was telling tonight, it's heart-wrenching to me to know how many people out there go through this and are suffering through this and are not believed by family members. What can they do? What can the average TI out there in the community do to help soften the blow to themselves? What can they do to help alleviate symptomology, Doctor?
Well, you know, one of the things we found, and you've been instrumental in kind of working with me on that, is using bone conduction headphones, aftershocks headphones, operating at a particular frequency and using binaural beats does seem to interfere with their ability to keep the brain waves asynchronous. And that is a large way of the way this happens, is it's, to be quick about it, it's two dissimilar interference waves in the brain creating another interference wave.
Yep.
And if you synchronize, you know, both hemispheres of the brain to operate at the same frequency, it seems to make targeting a lot more difficult. And one of the ways we do that is with bone conduction headsets and binaural beat programs. And Chris with Curious Realm actually does create and customizes those binaural beat programs for, or has done for a number of targeted individuals. And of course, you know, the big thing is really remember your family members do care about you, and they, so I mean, a lot of times I know you're, a lot of times the targeting is done intentionally to make you think your family is part of it. Most of the times when I've seen the investigations I've done, they're not. They are concerned, and they're certainly concerned that there's mental illness. And now that we're having a lot of these control shooters, they're really concerned. Kind of be ginger.
We're kind of losing you a little bit there, Doctor. Which is strange that we've had a crystal clear signal until it comes to the point of how do people get help? How do people stop this? That is the part that's coming through garbled. And, it is the fact, though, of, you know, much like you don't understand why you were targeted and why these things are happening to you, your family also doesn't understand the changes that you are undergoing. And that ontologic shock is happening to both of you in a totally dissimilar way. You know, and it can be hard for them to empathize with you in your situation, and it can be hard for you to empathize with them for not understanding you and your situation. So try to keep that open heart with your family, folks. Remember, like the doctor is saying, they are not there to harm you. Never, under any state of mind, under any state of influence, never forget what your root voice is. Ever. The day your voice starts telling you something other than what you know to be true, perk up and pay attention and fight that.
And never harm yourself or harm other people. If anything, if anyone is trying to convince you that the way out is to pick up a gun and shoot someplace up or harm others, then that is them trying to control you. That is not the way out. That's not the way to get publicity.
Yeah.
That's not the way to get an end to targeting. That's not the way.
Exactly. Those are the voices that are not you, that are not you. And you need to be acutely aware of that and acutely aware of what your inner voice actively is, you know, and that can be very hard. Once the haze of that technology hits you, and once because it's that windfall of brain activity is different. It's a different threshold for everybody, Doctor. You know, much like any psychological break is a different threshold for anybody. Same thing with the way that this influence works over people. It's a different threshold for everyone. So, I want to thank you for your time, as always, for coming on, having these candid conversations in such an open manner. It is so important to be able to talk about these things, to be able to have the conversation. How can TIs get in touch with you? What is there a direct email that you have or something like that set up, Doctor? How can people get in touch with you in a safe manner?
Through Facebook, and I know a lot of TIs hate using Facebook, but trust me, monitoring what's on your computer is the low tech end of this. So, don't worry yourself about having a Facebook page, because that's not.
Don't worry about your computer cookies.
And it's Guinea Pigs Technologies of Control on Facebook. Because it's, you know, the office is too busy to be inundated with calls there. And there have been some restrictions put on me as far as treating targeted individuals. So Facebook is the best way to get a hold of me. So
absolutely. Well, Doctor, I want to thank you for your time as always with this hugely important topic. This is one that is one of our crusades at this show. I am bound and determined to shout this from the mountaintop for as long as I can, my friend, because I think the work of people like yourself, people like the work of Robert Duncan, things like that are hugely important to getting the truth out there about this. So thank you so much for your time, as always, and as well for your friendship.
All right, always a pleasure being on, Chris.
All right. Take care, my friend. I'll share links, everything else. I'll let you go. I know you have practice in the morning for work, everything else. So take care. Take care of that beautiful baby of yours.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Take care. While you are online, everybody, checking out all of the amazing work of Dr. John Hall, his books are, of course, available over in the Curious Realm store. If you go to curiousrealm.com/store, right down there toward the bottom of the store, you can find his books. You can find all the books from all of our guests. There they are right there, guinea pigs. If you click it, it'll take you right to the Amazon link, all that kind of good stuff through our affiliateship. So stop on by, check all of that out, like, subscribe, follow. But don't go anywhere. Whatever you do while you're going to the website and checking it out, don't forget that after commercial break, we will be joined by Dennis Stone, the owner of America's Stonehenge. We will be talking about one of the oldest archaeological sites in America, what it means, what some of the alignments might mean, what the structures might be used for, so many other things with Dennis Stone, owner of America's Stonehenge, right after this, folks. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is my choice for CBD. They should be yours as well. They are hands down the best CBD that I have found on the market, folks. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com, use the code Curious7 to save 7% off of your entire cart of $50 or more. Amazing stuff there. Our guest in this segment is the awesome Dennis Stone. He is the owner of America's Stonehenge, one of the many stone ruins that are scattered around the New England area, and one of them that goes back to pre-Columbian times. I had a chance to visit there shortly before, I guess it was like September, and it was epic. I've had Dennis on numerous times, and as I told him every time, like, I lived right up the road from his site. Passed by it, I don't know how many times, and never went to it. I am highly regretive of that. Now that I have been there and seen it, it is such a magnificent location. Welcome back to the show, Dennis Stone. How are you doing, my friend?
Well, I'm doing great, Chris. Thank you so much for having me on again. And again, I'd like to congratulate you on your 100th show.
Thank you.
This year. Yeah, you're
Thank
welcome.
You. I appreciate that. We try hard to keep things going regularly and to make sure that we are never, ever providing repeat content. So the fact that we have guests that come back like you and you, like yourself, that come back again and again, we absolutely love it. It's great. All it does is further research and allow us to see what updates have been happening, new things that people have found out in their research. And this location, America's Stonehenge, you have actively had in your family since you were a kid.
That's right. Yeah, it goes back to the 1950s. And in 2 years, we'll be celebrating the 70th year that my dad first heard about this. It was on a radio show, just like we're doing right now. It was a big station out of Boston, and it was on a Friday night. And just listening to the show, it was called Yankee Arms, and the host was from Maine, just like you, Alton Hall Blackington. And he did the show. It was syndicated, besides a big station, it was syndicated around New England and a couple other stations. And the that evening, the whole subject was about this site. So that was in 1955. And my dad opened it up in 1958. So this year, we just celebrated our 65th year being open to the public, and you were here for that. It was so wonderful to meet you and see your family, too. You know, and we did that. We did another little episode, I think, in front of the Watch House.
Yeah, so, yeah. It was right there at the head of the snake, which is I was actively talking with someone this last weekend, Jason Quitt, about his work into symbology and things like that. And the snake was a huge one, specifically serpent mounds and their angles, things like that. And I directed him to you. I was like, you need to make sure and get a hold of Dennis Stone with this, because as opposed to an earthen mound, which are found frequently, this is a huge rock formation in the shape of a snake on your property.
Yeah, we didn't know about it until 2016. I found my first, what I thought looked like a snake. It had a head, body, and tail, and it was a short stone wall, about 27 feet length. And at one end, it was a little bit high. It had this rock, like a boulder, and it tapered down to a flat stone. And I'm like, looking at it, it was a rigid bedrock. It was straight. It was linear. And as I looked at it, I thought to myself, am I looking at a snake? And I had never ever thought of these stone walls looking like snakes, and I hadn't heard of that before. So I didn't have a frame of reference for it. And I told a few friends and researchers and staff people. And then I found a couple other walls up there that we've been going by for decades. And I'm looking at it a little closer and going like, huh, you know, this one looks like perhaps another serpent. It seems to have a head, a body, and tail. And one of them I found was a great big S-shaped serpent, about 140 feet long, with a kind of a triangular boulder head, and then it goes in a big sweeping S. And the spring of 2016, I had already kind of identified that one. And Scott Walters and Alan Butler from England, who's been on his show, America on Earth, and other TV shows too. Mm-hmm. They were all over, which Scott was kind of an entourage of probably about, I'd say about 15-20 people, and we were touring the site, and I took them out to show them specifically what I thought could be serpent walls, and they all looked at them and said, wow, you might be onto something. It wasn't until a meeting in Groton, Connecticut, and Connecticut is loaded with these stone structures all over Connecticut, and they had a conference down there, the New England Antiquities Research Association spring meeting, I believe it was, and a guest speaker got up and he spoke about a town called North Stonington, Connecticut. And again, we knew Connecticut had structures all over the state, but I never knew North Stonington had even one structure. Hmm. But the gentleman's name is Mark Starr. He goes by Malcolm Starr. He wrote the book Ceremonial Stonework that year, 2016. But before he spoke, I'm at one of the author's tables. I'm looking at all these books and I pick up his. It looked kind of interesting. I look at the back cover. 270 pictures, 8,000 structures, 25 categories of structures. I said, well, he must be talking about the whole Northeast, you know, because they're all over the Northeast. Mm. And as I look a little closer, I realize it's just the town of North Stonington. All of these structures are in a 35,000-acre town of North Stonington, Connecticut. One of the categories, as I was flipping through it, I'm like, they were serpent walls. And I'm like, oh, my God. And he lists something like 400 of them in that one town. And they're straight or linear. They're curvilinear. Sometimes you have a 90-degree head, bent, or tail. And some are curved, wow, like the curved one I mentioned, curvilinear, if you will. And the other type we found at our site was the one you mentioned at the beginning, kind of the big boulder where we did our interview. And that one I think might have been my – I mean, we've been walking by the Watch House since we opened. And Mr. Goodwin, the first researcher, was there in 1936 visiting the site. And in 1937, he purchased 20 acres of the site and began researching, studying – photographing, clearing, excavating, and he did a little bit of work in the Watch House, so he knew it was there, but nobody ever saw the serpentine shape to it. And if you look at it today, and I think that's the S-shaped one you're looking at, I believe. Yeah, that one's an early photograph because the trees are thinner there now since we did a forestry project, mm-hmm. but the wall goes from the right of the picture, goes off to the left, it goes into the distance to the right, and if you could, I don't think you can do it, but if you could expand that, you know, it actually goes way off to the left again, and it's in the far distance. It ends with another boulder, like a round boulder tail. Oh, you can zoom in a little bit. Yeah, you can see it goes off to the left, and it's kind of hard to see the very end of it because it's so far out there in the woods with the trees. But it goes off, yeah, about 140 feet, and it's a great big sweeping S. Farmer's walls started in the 1700s, so about 300 years of wall building, but they're fairly linear with some exceptions.
Well, because they're made to mark property lines. Property lines don't curve like a river like that.
Back and forth would not make sense, would it? unless you're following a river, but that's all bedrock there, you know, it's sitting on. So farmers built something like 240,000 miles of walls in New England. They say that's the highest number of miles of walls anywhere in the world in the New England area. And I didn't realize that until more recently, you know. But farmers' walls are pretty typical, like I say, marking boundaries, field clearing, stock fences. Sometimes they serve all three purposes, usually fairly straight. And you can find exceptions to that, you know, of course. These walls do with these big sweeping things. Some actually loop around, like the Watch House one, 2,550 feet counterclockwise. And it comes back in front of its boulder head or face, and it does a hump, and then it does a 90-degree bend to a pointed tail. And that pointed tail should have stuck out to all of us over the years. And it's so obvious now. You look at it and go, oh, look at that. It's amazing. And it's in front of its face in an Ouroboros, ancient Egyptian, Greek, and I've seen it Native American artwork where a snake kind of biting its tail kind of, and either the tail's in its mouth or it's next to its mouth. That is more rare. But I was, as you mentioned, the head of the snake is the boulder with the tail right in front of it, could represent the Ouroboros. So that might indicate wisdom. It could be wholesomeness. It could be like infinity, you know. But also a serpent can be healing. Like on a medical staff, there's two snakes on it. But it's in the Bible. It's St. Patty. It's Adam and Eve. It's all over the world. The Egyptians had it. It could be it's protecting the 15 acres of the main site. You know, it wraps right around what could be considered the sacred area up there. That's a possibility. Yeah. If we could talk to the builders, we know for sure, but that's what it looks like.
Well, and that is one of the most fascinating things is the builders. As of yet unknown, it's not like there is an incredible amount of settlement there. There was at one point a small encampment toward the front of the property where everybody parks, things like that. That was obviously... encamped in by the people who built the place. But aside from that, it's not like it was occupied. It's not like you have found, piles of chert, let's say, from people napping flint. You haven't found piles of animal bones from sacrifice or hunting, you know, things like that.
Right, household goods, and then the archaeologists, they use the word midden, you know, it's like a trash pit, like you were describing, you know. And that's not what we find there. It's fairly clean archaeologically. We've done 85 years of archaeological work on this site. But if you took all the shovel test pits, excavations, and put them all together, it would be maybe about an acre out of the 106 acres of land there, you know. So probably just under 1% of the hilltop's actually been excavated, although they did a lot of work. And it is quite a bit of, you know, time to do all of that. Excavation's usually pretty slow. And you might find a midden or something like that, but we just don't find that. Then the other sites in the Northeast, they number over 800, and North Stonington is considered a site. And it can be just a chamber, like a next door town is Windham, New Hampshire, has a chamber. We consider that a site too.
Sure.
But I don't think it's a habitat site. I think it's a place of worship, probably a ceremonial site that included the astronomical alignments, because we have something like 57 alignments for the sun, moon, and stars. And that brings in the serpent walls again, too. The serpent walls might be inspired, perhaps, by the constellation Draco in the northern hemisphere. In the southern hemisphere, you have other constellations, obviously. And, you know, I did visit the Great Serpent Mound in Ohio. We were there in June. We traveled up from Georgia. We had seen the Etowah Mounds in Georgia this year. And then we went through Ohio and saw the Sight Mound and then Serpent Mound. We met my son out there. My son's an engineer at Raytheon, but he's also a rally race car driver, and they happened to have a race going on that week in Chillicothe. So he met his whole team. Some actually flew in from New Hampshire or whatever into Ohio, and we met him at the Serpent Mound. So it was a really kind of a neat thing to have my son with his team meet us right at the Great Serpent Mound in Ohio. And that's amazing. And it's about 1,350 feet long. It's built on a, I think, a, what's described as a stone foundation, if you will, but it is an earthen serpent. Ours being 2,550 feet is about twice as long from what we understand of our particular serpent today. So it could be one of the biggest serpent effigies, you know, either stone or earth or whatever, but it is stone in this case, maybe anywhere, unless we find out next year somebody's got one that's, you know, 3,000 feet long, which is very possible somewhere. My friend Maria Wheatley from England, you know, she's really big on dowsing. She's an archaeologist. Her dad did visit us back 40 years ago. She goes to Sedona. She goes out to L.A. Mm. She just came back from Egypt and Malta. She does these tours, and she's trying to work her schedule into coming to our site. And she's sending people to our site. In fact, one of them came, and then she met her over in Malta, you know, like the week after. But she's been sending me pictures of England, and we've been there many times to England and Scotland, Wales. But she sent me pictures of serpent walls in England, and I didn't know they existed. I knew Scott Walters had one up in Scotland that he did on one of his episodes about the serpents, but they're in England. I'm like, wow. And that's, but our serpent walls, we think today, you know, they're all over the Northeast. As you mentioned, they're in Kentucky, and Mark Eddy, my friend, and you know, Mark, he sends me, you know, Mark Eddy, he's a great guy. He's in West Virginia, and he's been sending me stuff for years. He sent me a picture of one in Kentucky, a serpent wall. And it's very remote, very difficult to find. A woman wrote it up. She was an archaeologist, I believe, in 1990. And it has a big, wide open mouth. I mean, the wall, you know, it has a serpent body with this great big two walls that come out like a mouth, kind of like the Great Serpent Mound in Ohio, except that's Earth again. And I have one of those by what we call the lower well. I think you look at the way it starts inside the main site. It goes true south. And we've always called it the true south wall. There's a chain link fence that Mr. Goodwin put up 85 years ago or 86 years ago around the main site that you saw, the green fence. It's still in remarkable shape. They knew how to make things back then. There's a boulder right there. And I thought after finding it, maybe we knew the wall was there, but deciding maybe it's a serpent wall, is that might be its prey or maybe it's pregnant. You know, some of these walls, not only here, but in Connecticut, have the body gets wider, like in the middle kind of ish. And then it goes back to its regular, you know, width. And some people suggest that's representing either, you know, it ate its prey or it's a pregnant snake.
Yeah.
And we have that too. But it has this big wide mouth, and it reminds me of the one in Kentucky. But we found it in Winnipeg, Canada, and Pox Canada is working on their serpent walls up there. We had a couple that visited. The woman's sister moved to New Hampshire, so they're going to come back again and visit us quite often. But they were down late summer, and then when she was heading back, I think they drove back, she was sending me pictures of her serpent walls, and I'm like, it's the same thing way up in Winnipeg. They're in Alabama, and they're in Mount Shasta. There's a town called Weed, and I got 110 pictures of serpent walls, and again, they look like what we have out here in the east, you know, in the northeast. So it could be a North American stone wall serpent thing going on.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And I mean, the symbology behind that is huge, especially whenever you start looking at, once again, the astronomic alignments of this location. I've got the map up right now, of just a couple of the alignments. Even when I was there, I showed you a lunar alignment that wasn't on here and took a picture of it for you. Like the day before the moon would have risen over the stone. And
exactly
what I find interesting is specifically not just the rock wall, and not just the caves and their construction, but the difference between the rocks that are used for pointing location and the rocks that are used to catch the sun are different and made up different. I mean, I remember when I was there, you, and even the altar stone, things like that. When I was there, you allowed me to take a couple of the rocks. And the reason I did was because they're a different color than the rest of the rocks. And they specifically have like, flecks inside of it of mica, all kinds of things. Like I'm It's New Hampshire. It's the Granite State.
It is the Granite State. Yeah.
But this is different than your typical average granite. It is far, far shinier. Like chicoyance wise, anything like that, like what you would normally get from granite, where there's the shimmering from mica, that kind of stuff. Like when this hits daylight, it shines in a different way.
Yeah, yeah. You wonder if that was an attraction to that hill. The hill has some features about it that I think would have made it an attractive hill to set up this kind of site on top of, you know.
Yeah.
It does have an earthquake fault line going, and it splits the hill going east to west. It splits the hill right in half. And I was talking to Maria about that. And in Wales to England, there's about 700 stone ancient stone circles, and they're built on or with a mile and a half, she said, of the fault lines. I know this about the equal number in Scotland because I've been up there, but I don't know if they're on fault lines up there. That's something I've been trying to find out. But Machu Picchu is built on a fault line, too, and they say that was all intentional, you know. And we've been to Delphi in Greece, and there was a fault because some of the gases came out, they think, affected the people that were the oracles?
Yeah, oracles were just huffing natural gas all day.
Yeah, and it affected their, you know. Yeah, it really, I think it did. I didn't have that happen when I was there, but yeah, you got a lot of different pictures. That's the east-west chamber. And to me, it runs true east and west, and it runs about 30 feet-ish, not quite, but it's like the ones I've seen in France called galley or gallery graves, and they always run east and west, and they're 20 to 60 feet length. They were used as tombs, and they're in Holland. They call them the Giant's Bed, the Hoodenbidden, and they're also in northwest Ireland. We went all over Ireland. We didn't get to the northwest part. We saw so many megalithic sites, but I didn't get to see the gallery graves. I believe they're in Spain too, but that's a nice photograph looking south. That's looking south from the astronomical platform, kind of. Well, maybe from the ramp area, but it's looking south. You can see the table, and beyond the table, which is about, you know, 4.5 tons, it's about just under 6 by about 9 feet in length. And, it sits on four legs, and just beyond that is a vertical slab. It's one of the monoliths, and just beyond that is the entrance to the biggest chamber we call the Oracle Chamber. It's hidden behind that stone, actually. And if you could look to the left, which you can in this picture, there's another one of these upright monoliths. So there are two monoliths on either side of the table. I used to refer to them as sentinel stones, kind of guardian stones, and one of them's a little bit more narrower, if you will, and the other one's kind of wider. And I know we've been to England and the West Kennet Avenue, not too far from Stonehenge, another ancient megalithic site called the West Kennet Avenue. They had the female and male represented by upright stones, and the wider ones were the female, I believe, the more narrow ones were the male, kind of a symbolism, I think, you know, male, female, duality, that kind of thing. So it's a possibility. But the table, as you look at it, you can see a stone on the far side of the table, kind of on the bedrock. You can see like a slab down there. Just I think you're a little bit. Yeah, right there. Perfect. That stone, we believe, is a roof slab, another slab that belongs on top of the chamber. If you can scroll up on the picture now to the right a little bit. Yeah, go right up there to the right. You see the right. You can see a roof slab on the top right. Yes. This stone, we believe, fits right into that little notch right there. The heavier part of the stone would have been on the right on the ramp, kind of cantilevered, with a very thin part you can't see hidden by the table, would actually fit into that little slot. Dr. David Stuart Smith, who spent 40 years with us, he was a stonemason. He had a doctorate in historical anthropology, theology, and he spent the 70s from 72 to 77 working for what is today called English Heritage. He was in Scotland and England doing repairs on megalithic and medieval structures, and he became a master stonemason over there. And he's from Connecticut. So when he came back home around 78, he became aware that these sites exist in the Northeast. He was quite shocked. He was not only happily surprised, but he was beside himself because I've been spending 7 years over there, and he learned so much over there. And it was called the Ancient Monuments, whatever it was called. Now it's English Heritage, you know. And so he has an eye for that kind of thing. He can tell where these kind of stones belong. I'm sure not perfectly, we'll never really know, but he was very, very good at that, you know, looking at the sign, the size, the shape. He also found out that these slabs, whether it's a table, monoliths, roof slabs, any of these type of stones were all taken off the bedrock, they were actually struck, and they were actually shaped, as you mentioned earlier, like making an arrowhead when you do the napping. But it was on a grand scale. And our Dr. Gary Hume, our state archaeologist 40 years ago, mainstream, kind of conventionalist, didn't know about stone ruins. You know, that wasn't part of his learning, looking at arrowheads and points or maybe colonial stuff. These sites didn't exist in his world. But he actually opened his mind up to join us back around 1980, and he did three projects. And he worked with Dr. David Stewart Smith on it. And he was a lithic specialist. He knew how they made stone tools, like Native Americans in the ancient past. And he said, your big slabs here were shaped using Stone Age technology in the same manner as if somebody was making a arrowhead, a stone axe, or stone hoe, or a stone spear. It's the same technology. It's not Metal Age technology. It's Stone Age, and it's napping or pressure flaking or percussion flaking, you know?
Yeah.
And we have 34 slabs like the table, not exactly in that shape, about the size of that, all over the hilltop. There's 34 of them we got now, and they've all been raised off the bedrock, propped up with another stone, a small stone.
Yeah.
In the edge of them, you can see where they were actually were all dimpled, where they were striking it and doing percussion flaking to dress or shape it. And they abandoned this whole project. And in 82, we knew of one, and that's when Dr. Gary Hume got on that project. And then we kept finding more of them. And just in the last couple of years, he probably found 15 more. And I think it was like last year or the year before, it suddenly dawned on me. I was like, duh, why didn't I think these people had a much grander plan for this site with all these massive slabs to be brought up, some of them 1,000 feet from the main site. Maybe they had a much bigger plan for this place. And then it's like, well, why did they stop? You know, what happened to these people? So I raised the question, you know.
Now granted, the table that we're looking at, the quote unquote sacrificial table, as it's been dubbed, in so many shows, things like that. I am a big believer that your site was used more than likely for initiation of some sort, not just with the archaeoastronomy alignments that it has, but with the alignments of caves and things like the man-made caves, the caverns, the way that they connect in different chambers, even underneath by, and the main reason I think this is because, in Minoa, ancient Greece, things like that, they were, even in Rome, they were known to use chambers adjacent or underneath their altars, to have the words of the god come out from underneath the altar before the sacrifice happened, things like that. You have a chamber precisely like that under the table.
It's just to the left of the table, and it's actually kind of hidden too. You don't really know it's there, you know?
I mean, this whole little wall right here is a chamber.
It's almost 30 feet long. Yeah. It's almost 30 feet north and south, you know?
Yeah.
And it's
pretty good size. The window is, and once again, I would love to come and do acoustic measurements, things like that in there.
That's funny you said that, because Scott Walters, when he did the show, he's been back many times since, but when he was doing the show, he goes, this, I think acoustic archaeology, he goes, you got to do a little bit more in here, because it's like the structure itself seems to be acoustical, you know, but also
even the positioning of the large slabs to the table, to me ring out acoustic, as though whoever's laying on the table can hear a message being spoken to that rock.
I think they've been testing Stonehenge for that. I saw a show on about that, and it was pretty phenomenal.
And there are numerous sites like that all over the world where, you know, even when you get to, you were saying Delphi, that kind of stuff, Epidaurus, you know, where you can strike a match down at the bottom of the theater and hear it like it's next to you at the top of the theater.
That's pretty amazing.
They had amazing knowledge of acoustics, Dennis, and especially for things like this. I'm curious, from the top of the table looking up, have you ever done any archaeoastronomic alignment to see if, you know, like what constellation would be in the sky at these points of the year where the sun is over where the sun is over the sight stones that you have.
I think what we did starting around 1999, I had a retired Harvard. He was a professor of the Graduate School of Architecture at Harvard University. Really nice guy. And he was so much into the design of our site. And also the other thing is water tables. He did a lot with the United States Geological Service. And I went on with him a couple times on the road to talk to some of the people in the USGS in New Hampshire. This one covers Vermont, too, about what was the water like, the rivers and everything back 4,000 years ago. And they really don't have any precise information. They have more general stuff. But it looks like our place was almost on a peninsula, for one thing. But the architecture of the site was this other big thing. And he actually – we went to Greece for a honeymoon, and he designed the what was it over there? We saw the building too. He actually has his name on the building. And also, I think over in Iraq, the U.S. School or university, he actually designed that. So he was pretty well known in the architectural world, you know, and he just passed away not too long ago. He lived in Massachusetts. But we used to go in the Oracle Chamber and look up the chimney and try to look at stars, because they do pass overhead, obviously, the zenith stars. You know, the sun will never really go vertical because we're, you know, we're 43-degree latitude. But the stars, and we were looking at that back, I would say 2000, 1999, you know. I was still working at the airline, so I was kind of trying to balance all of this stuff, too, at the same time. But we did go up there at night. And we also had to figure out that the Earth's tilt has changed a little bit in 4,000 years, too. Yeah. So we had to take that into account. That work was never complete. Yeah, it was never complete. We should do more with that, really.
Well,
you know?
Well, and honestly, like I said, specifically on the days of the solstice and equinox alignments that you have where the sun and the moon rise over these stones, to see precisely which constellations are directly above that table.
Exactly.
Because I think that would be more of an initiation table where the initiate lays down, you know, something like that. And the story is being told once again through the stars overhead.
Yeah. Even I've heard even more modern day initiations. I'm trying to think of some of the groups. I'm not sure about the Masons, but there is the Skull and Bones, I think, at Yale. They do things like that with their initiates, you know, and it's like a whole ceremony, and it's very emotional and everything, you know.
Absolutely.
You might be onto something with that, too. I mean, it's a really good thought, because we always, you know, not to say it was ceremonial, but we've also had people talk about maybe it was a place of initiation, of training, of learning, you know. And not just astronomy, as you mentioned, but other things, too. There is a geometry to the site, too.
There is.
And I don't think you have that map. I don't know if I ever sent it to you, but my dad did one and another researcher did one. And they went from specific points all around the property, like a standing stone to another one to another one. You come up with equilateral, isosceles, Pythagorean triangles. And you can have a few of them that will be coincidental. So, but when you have repeating patterns, it seems to maybe not be a coincidence. You know, you have to be careful about that. I took that in college, statistics and probability, but it looks like there's a repeating pattern of that all over the hilltop. Yeah. So that'd be kind of mathematical. And then we have the astronomical. And then you have the architecture of the site, too. That's a beautiful one of the I believe it's a winter solstice sunset. And that's coming up, gee whiz, in a month, you know, it's going to be happening. And we'll be having a celebration for that in a drumming circle that day. That was first cleared out in 1965, and it was because of the book by Gerald Hopkins. He was English. He was at Boston University and the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Mass. And he wrote the book Stonehenge Decoded, and then he wrote a couple other books. And that book triggered a TV show on CBS, The Mystery of Stonehenge. And I have seen that movie twice. I haven't seen it since the 70s, but it first aired in 65. And people like my dad, the other researchers, people from the New England Antiquities Research Association, they saw that. They said, you know, I wonder if these standing stones surrounding the main site, these monoliths, have a meaning astronomically. So that's why they began clearing in 1965. And a gentleman that did it actually became a nuclear engineer. And he's a gentleman that installed the reactors on the Nimitz, you know, the tic-tac UFO Nimitz. He's the one who put the reactors on in 69 and 70. Yeah. And he came up in his bug-eye Triumph for the winter solstice of 1970, parked at his mom and dad's house. We met him. It was about over a foot of snow. He had built a wooden snowmobile as a kid. He built a pad wheel boat when he was a kid. He was a very, very, very amazing guy. I was just talking to him yesterday. He actually ended up in the nuclear industry all over the world, in France, South Africa, up in Alaska. He ended up finishing up his career when Fukushima went off. He was just about to head back to Charlotte, North Carolina for Westinghouse, I believe it was. And they moved him to Tokyo to work on the mess over there. And he ended up being the last person on the five-person. So he had these bookends of the Nimitz and Fukushima. But he's still very interested in the site. He worked there for years, from 63 when he was a kid, up to became a manager in 68, and then he got into working for the on the Nimitz, you know. He took the first photograph, I found out 2 years ago. He said, "Dennis, I have two pictures from 1967 of the sun setting on that stone." I said, "I thought it was 1970, because that's when I went down with my dad, my neighbor, and he had the snowmobile. He broke the trail. We walked up and saw the first clear pictures were with us. What he took, it was the cirrus clouds. And with the cirrus clouds, you could just see like a bright spot setting on that stone. But he cleared that out using first an axe, and then he borrowed a neighbor who was a doctor. He borrowed his chainsaw and went up there, and they cleared about 800 feet of trees to actually see that, starting in 65. Those are also something we discovered in the last – since 2016. I started finding not only serpent walls, but I started finding what we call windows.
Yeah, yeah.
And that one right there – I think I showed you a couple of those when you were up there.
Yep.
And that one there has –
Go ahead.
That one has cobble. Yeah, I'm sorry, Chris. I mean to step on you. That has a couple cobbles in it. Those stones inside of it. Yep. I didn't move them, take them out, but I just took my finger and touched them. They're all loose. They're just sitting in. We have two like that. Two windows that have cobbles. You wonder if they're like little offerings, these little cobbles. I have no idea, but they're not, you know, holding the lintel stone up. Today we have, I think, 25 windows. Maria Wheatley, again, in England, sent me pictures after I did a couple podcasts. She goes, "Stay on the line." Afterwards, Dartmoor, England, she sends me pictures of her window. She goes, "They're called soul holes. It was for the spirits to go through." That's their interpretation today.
Interesting.
And that's about the first one I found. And actually, that one, when you go to another picture, it has a stone shutter that actually fits inside. Normally, we tell our visitors and all our staff, please don't touch anything, don't move anything. But one of my assistant archaeologists, he's a stonemason. He went to Boulder for that, and he's been doing it for 30-something years. He said, "Dennis, can I take this stone?" He has a great eye. He used to work with David Stuart Smith. "Can I pick it up and put it inside that opening? Because I think you have a stone shutter here." So we said, "Well, okay, we'll do that for research." So we removed the carefully. We stuck it inside. It fit perfectly. Then we put it back into the earth. It went about 8 inches into the earth, standing up vertically. We have found other stone shutters. Some of them are stacked up horizontally. And some of these stone windows are, there's four of them next to each other. We have two examples of that. And then there's others that are just by themselves. But North Stonington, Connecticut, when I opened that book up in 2017, I looked at them like, there's another category. It's windows. They have the same thing like that down in North Stonington in the wall. So it's not unusual here, but what a surprise to find these things. You know, after decades of being here, never noticing them.
Well, and using those specifically, Dennis, people may look at the image on screen right now and be like, "Oh, it's a wall in the middle of the woods." Those are not incredibly old trees.
They are maybe
100 years old, something like that. So at one point, this was wide open field. So
it was
think of those as peep sites that you would sight a mountain point off in the distance or something like that to find a cardinal direction or to sight a star coming up over the horizon at certain times of year. That is one of the things that I've mentioned specifically about the bee cave structures that are the beehive structures that are there, the little buildings. Are they aligned specifically to rising of constellations, things like that? It seems as though it would be a perfect spot for sighting stars, things like that. As a backyard astronomer myself, I'm even building a small shade that I can pop up on my fence whenever I'm doing it to block out my neighbor's lights.
Dark sky.
Because even though you're in a dark location, if you're trying to focus specifically on one point, if the moon's on the side of you, something like that, it can be hard to see stars on the horizon.
You're right on the money about that. And the hilltop is all bedrock with a very thin layer of soil. And mm-hmm. David Stuart Smith mentioned that, you know, and we're kind of aware of it, but he really put it into good words and really understandable. Because basically it's windblown particles and vegetation decay. It takes about 125 years in New Hampshire and New England for an inch of soil to accumulate from windblown soil and particles just coming in there. Everything on that hilltop, including if you look at that structure right there, it's sitting on bedrock. The stone walls, they cover the entire 110 acres, yep. including the serpentine walls. When they built this site, I think they had very little soil up there. And then very slowly, the soil has accumulated. And then the forest and the vegetation came in. And it became almost a jungle up there. So any astronomical alignments they could have seen many, many years later, the trees, the forest, completely covered. Yeah. Not only you couldn't see the horizon, as you mentioned, but you can even see some of the structures. They were buried in the woods like a jungle down in like Mexico. And that's why those windows haven't been found until the last few years. It was just, they were just covered with brush, trees. And we had a forestry project. We did 2 years during the winter, starting in 2019 to 2021. We finally finished it up, and they did the 110 acres. They thinned all the hilltop. They did it to remove dead, dying, diseased, damaged trees. They also took out the type of foliage that shouldn't be there anyway. You know what I mean?
It's non-native, invasive foliage, things
invasive,
like that.
Invasive. That's what I'm looking for. I'm sorry. But they opened up all the alignments. And now we have lunar alignments that we never opened up. The lunar major alignments were never opened up because we started the project in 65. So all the way up to now, we just basically kind of finished it all. I suppose we'll never be done with that. But now you can kind of see the horizon pretty
just
good.
Just a massive number of alignments, man.
Yeah. Those are some of the 57. And most of those there are what we call type one. It's actually watching a sun, moon, or star rise or set over like a stone. Or you could have wood if Woodhenge over in England, also at Cahokia in Illinois. But ours are stone, and you have to have a backsight and a foresight. Backsight is the one closest to where you stand. The foresight is the one in the distance you're looking at. And then you see the sun behind it, moon, or whatever. Well, we have that. We have the backsight and the foresight. Otherwise, you don't have an alignment. And we also have the other type, which is called – some people call it type two. It's an illumination, and that's inside that watch house, mm-hmm. the serpent head, the chamber. And that's when the light goes in and causes a shadow and light effect. So that would be like type two alignment. We have at least one of those. There's a deer calving inside the oracle chamber. There's a window there. It's now the exit, and I know you walked through there with me. We might use that's the one in the watch house.
Yeah.
And we could never see it because the trees going to our neighbor's property were blocking it. You could never see it even with the leaves off the trees. So when we did the forestry thing, a licensed forester's name was Brian. I said, Brian, you have to open this as far as you can to the neighbor's property because I want the sunlight to come into this chamber. Because that rock was written about even in Hans Holz's book in 1992, long before Columbus, all about our site. Hans had been coming up since 1970, doing different experiences, bringing up different psychics to our site. So 92, he wrote the book on Columbus's 500th year anniversary. Oh. And Barbara Hand Cloud actually wrote the foreword, and she's talking about that in the foreword of the book, that stone right there, that quartzite stone. And she had her own interpretation of it, you know. One of our other staff members, she was a high school Spanish teacher too. She wrote a book in 1996. It was the first souvenir book we did. We just did – my daughter and I just did an update, did our own just recently in the last couple of years. But she talks about that in 1996. And so what we found out, my friend Haley, who you interviewed at down in Las Vegas last week. She did her PowerPoint presentation. She was here in 2020, and she had Sunseeker in her phone. She got into the back of the chamber. The trees had not been cleared by then. And she goes, if you're here and you're standing here on the equinox sunrise, I think it's going to get illuminated around 9-ish in the morning, roughly. The next year, the trees had already been cleared out. It went back there in the equinox. And basically what you see there, that picture was taken about 8 o'clock. And the one you showed before that was at 8:30. So that shadow and light actually framed the top of the stone. And then it morphs into it looks like a hand with an index finger pointing back at it. Our interpretation of that is...
To me, it looks like a hand outstretched.
Almost. The shadow looks pretty cool, too. It depends on what you're looking at, either the shadow or the light part of it. But the fact that it frames the top of the shape of that stone is pretty cool. And 30 minutes later at 8:30 a.m. in the morning, it actually turned into, it looks like a hand with an index finger pointing back at that. And our interpretation today, I've been to New Grange in Ireland, is that this might represent, that chamber might represent a womb. And what it is a sun, the rays, the fertilization, the egg. And this illumination actually is, you know, it's about fertility, and it's in the spring equinox. But we found out this year, 3 years later, I'm standing there at 7:30 because we have a couple other alignments earlier in the morning on the equinox, a big 8-foot slab that fell down. The sun rises over where that stone was standing. And then there's one near the oracle chamber, and that's just about 20 minutes later or so. And then we go down there and watch the third equinox event, solar event, if you will. And I'm talking to a lady with my back to the chamber, kind of like when you and I were interviewing there.
Yeah, yeah.
But I turned, but I was sitting at that time, but I was standing next to this, and I just happened to turn around while we're talking, and I looked into the chamber at 7:30. I'd never done that before. And I don't know if you have that picture, but the bottom of the stone has a perfect shadow-like framing it. So it frames it at the bottom at 7:30. 30 minutes later, it goes to the top of that, what could be an egg perhaps. It frames it perfectly. And then at 8:30, 1 hour after the beginning of this illumination, it looks like a hand, again, with the index finger pointing back, maybe, at this fertilized egg. And that may be, you know, crazy. It might be incorrect. But we've been to quite a few sites around the world. Huh. And even at Chaco Canyon on the equinox, there's an illumination. It's not this, the point, the you know, they have a dagger for the summer solstice, the two daggers for the winter solstice at Chaco Canyon in New Mexico, which we've been to. We haven't been up on the butte to see that. It's restricted. But on the equinox, the light hits a serpent that's, and it splits the serpent with a shadow light right down the middle on the equinox.
Yeah.
And remember, we're talking about the head of a serpent, the womb next to it, and then this illumination. So that chamber has a lot of things going. And that boulder, by the way, is a February 1st cross quarter day. The ancient Celts called it Imbolc. Candlemas and Groundhog's Day today is around that time.
Yep.
It's a mid-season. The first hump in that body behind it is November 1st. It's called Samhain by the ancient Celts. It's the All Saints Day today, the day after Halloween. And that hump actually is where the sun will rise on that. So there's a lot of stuff going on with that watch house, including two bones that were looked at the Smithsonian in 1968, and they were identified as bison by two physical anthropologists in 1968.
Now,
what the heck's a bison bone doing in that chamber? I have
now the quartzite light and shadow, as we were talking, an image popped into my head. And the concept of as above, so below popped into my head, which is very much an initiation phrase, things like that, the whole concept of what is in the heavens is reflected here on earth, things like that.
Well, that's so funny, Chris. That's the name of my PowerPoint presentation, although I'm going to update it now. But I put that on 2019. I started using that PowerPoint, and that was the kind of the theme, as above, so below.
The Egyptian letter D there. If you look at the hieroglyph for the letter D in the Egyptian alphabet, the outstretched hand. Strikingly familiar to the hand that you have here at the bottom of the screen in the image inside of there. And then once again, the outstretched palm of the shadow on top of it. So
kind
the,
of, yeah,
the
yeah.
lit area, the shadow area, both of them being a hand, both of them representing the yin, the yang,
the yin and yang.
As you were talking, and it never even dawned on me, the hand up above it in shadow as well, and the whole concept of those two being tied together. But when I saw the hand on the bottom, that's when I was like, that looks like the letter D in hieroglyphics. That is wild.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah. Like it looks really cool. Smack like the letter D. Just
there's a cave out in Oklahoma called the Anubis Cave, and Gloria Fowley and Nira and other people working on that. But actually, part of the illumination, there's five caves, and one of them, there's a dangling sun, and they say there's a lot of Egyptian Anubis and all of that, a lot of that in there. And there's a sun, but there's also on the side of it, like a dangling half a sun. And during the course of that illumination, it looks like a hand with a big thumb stuck out. And that's in a shadow, kind of a shadow thumb with a light around the thumb, just a reverse of. But anyway, it goes into the, actually goes into the dangling sun, and momentarily it fits perfectly in there during, I believe it was the equinox. It's the equinox too. Sunrise. I'm like, oh, that's the equinox. In Colorado, there's two caves, the Pathfinder and the Crack Cave. And then we talked about the Chaco and also the Mojave North Cave in California, which I haven't been to. But those are all equinox illuminations. In the same morning we're having ours, you could actually hop on a plane, or maybe we should do a Facebook from those places. They have those going on the same time or a little bit later in the day, obviously a different time zone. But at Chichen Itza, Kukulkan's going down the staircase, 91 staircases with a shadow and light on the equinox. So there's a serpent going on there, a serpent head, the womb. So there's a serpentine equinox going on, you know, across the U.S. and going into Mexico. You know, you wonder, you know, how can that be just a coincidence? I don't know, you know.
Well, and specifically when you start getting into the age of this site, and of course, the rock cannot be aged. However, when you start getting into local tales of the site, when you start getting into the history of the site, when you start getting into the local settlement of the site, by Anglos, and when they came upon it, because it was there when they moved there, and when they asked the natives who lived in the area, they were like, I don't know, we've just kind of used it.
It's
been there since we got here. We didn't build it, but it sure is useful.
Exactly. You know, there is a site that is in Connecticut. Another one, I mentioned there's many of them, but the Gungeewomp site, which is near the Navy base in Groton. And the state now has taken over part of that. And University of Connecticut's Dr. McBride, and he actually came up and visited us last fall. I think he was pretty impressed by our site. He was impressed by Gungeewomp, but again, it's out of his realm. You know, it's not pottery. It's not a point. It's a great big complex of stone structures. But Gungeewomp was written about in 1654. We believe they were referring to Gungeewomp. A guy named John Pynchon wrote to Governor Winthrop, the second Governor John Winthrop, and he wrote to him in 1654 asking what these stone structures were. So if these were all built by our colonial settlers, why is somebody in 1654 saying, you know, what is this, you know, back then, you know? But we have been using optically stimulated luminescence, and they've been doing it from here to Virginia on 22 sites, and the results are coming out pre-colonial and pre-Columbian dates. And they actually can date dirt when it saw the light of day last. So if you build a chamber and the dirt on the roof or next to it is undisturbed, you get the core, they send it out. 2 years later, you get the results back. You know that the structure was there and the dirt came in after. You can kind of relatively date this, you know, the structure, saying, okay, the dirt dated to this era, so we know the structure is at least this old. And that's what they did at our site. One of the four places they took the dirt samples from, actually two stone and two dirt, one of the dirt sediment samples came from near the end of the tail of that serpent by the watch house.
Oh, wow.
And the date on that was the dirt was there in 1400 AD, hadn't been, so 600 years ago. So the wall wasn't built by the you know, settlers 200 or 300 years ago. This thing was already sitting there in 1400. That's before Columbus.
There are definitely more than one location in the Northeast that is pre-Columbian of exploration. Everything from Viking to possible Knights Templar, all kinds of things.
All of that. So fascinating, too. Yeah.
And, you know, Templar would be interesting in your area, especially knowing its proximity to Oak Island, all that kind of stuff. There are quite a few sites right there in New England that kind of bear the mark.
You'd like the Westford Night, which is 25 miles from us. And we actually had that full cast of that night in our visitor center. You can actually see it there. And I don't know. I think I have a hooked X out by the Glacial Cliff Shelter. We found pottery out there that was Native American that dated about 2,000 to 2,500 years old. That was a habitat site. that glacial cliff shelter is on the west side of the property. You and I, we didn't get out there because there's just so much to explore. Yeah. You know, we were, but if you come back again, I'd love to take you out there. So in 1959,
I would love to come back for days and days and days, Dennis.
You can come back.
I don't think I could spend enough time.
Come up. We're open all the time, and we'd love to have you. I've been talking about you coming up this summer and everything. And if you tent, I have a perfect place for a tent. If you don't tent, you come up every day. We're open up. I'll open up special hours for you. You know, maybe we could try that experiment with the table, too. You know, maybe we can use like an app on a phone and try to calculate. Well, you know, that'd be kind of fun. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. That would be epic because, once again, the search for alignments and reasons for the more alignments you can find, the closer you come to finding the reason for the alignments.
Exactly.
You know, because once again, like you said, things have changed. Heck, things have changed just in our lifetime, Dennis. Like right now, you can look it up right now. The North Pole is on the move almost a mile a day. It's scary. It's scary.
Yeah. It's
just changing. Roaming around.
Yeah.
Right. It's kind of disturbing about.
Some of these things we can help date the construction time, perhaps, you know, which is pretty good. You know? Definitely. Yeah. Now, so you got to come up. You know, you got to come up, bring the family.
Absolutely.
pick a nice days, you know, no rain, no snow you have to deal with, but which we're actually may have a few snow flurries coming up soon. I'm not looking.
Seems
I love
like
the winters,
it.
But I don't. I mean, yes, I get like older. I don't like shoveling that much.
Well, let everybody know, Dennis, because I mean, you guys, of course, have a YouTube channel, all kind of good stuff. Your YouTube channel is embedded on our videos page. But y'all just put a video out about the Oracle Chamber that was really cool here in the last couple days. You have all kinds of videos on there. But let everybody know where they can go to find out more about America's Stonehenge, where they can, if they're local, where they can go to get involved, where they can go to bring groups up. Honestly, it's one of those like, bring your kindergarten group up there. That kind
Speaking
of,
stuff. Of that, I got to get up tomorrow morning, and we got, I think, 84 kids coming up. And the school was here last week with 84 kids. And about 3 weeks ago, the same school was up for about the same number of children. So, we love having school groups. After COVID, they're coming back now, finally. That was a couple of years where there was none. And but we're on, as you mentioned, we're on TikTok. We have a YouTube. We're on YouTube, as you mentioned, but we're on TikTok also, Facebook. But if you go to our webpage, StonehengeUSA.com, they can go in there, and we have links to all of this. We have a 11-minute video we show in our theater. We have a free app download. You put that on your phone. It's a mobile app. And you can do a complete virtual tour of the site, just as if you were there visiting us. So you can be on your lazy boy at home, do a complete virtual tour. If you use it when you visit us, you can walk around, and it will actually talk to your pictures and text as you're walking. And we also have a four-page map. But the website's really good, and it has pictures, it has information, a phone number, it has email. You can also give us a call if you like, have a question. We have events coming up like a winter solstice. Of course, we mentioned that. We'll have a drumming circle that day. On the 17th, we'll actually have a ceremony. The woman that's been doing it for years said, I'd like to do it on Saturday, the 17th. I'm available. So that's a few days before the solstice. And we have VIP tours going on again. After COVID, we started doing that just recently. Before COVID, I was doing VIP tours. And finally getting back into that again. So that's by reservation. And we
awesome.
We're thinking of doing stargazing next year in the fall. Ooh. We have a huge area. We'll talk about the stars. We'll talk about the constellations. And we may have some guest speakers come in, which would be pretty cool, you know, about astronomy, astrology, that kind of thing. We might be doing that. Heck probably next September and October, I think. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Dennis, I want to thank you so much for your time as always. I love our conversations, and your site is one of the most fascinating I have ever been to in my life. The fact that you guys keep finding more and digging into the history of this is absolutely awesome. Keep it up. We are here to support you in any way that we can, my friend.
Well, thank you, Chris. And again, Craig, congratulations on the 100 and to another 100 more. And I hope I can be part of that. I love being on your show. And yeah, come on up anytime. And maybe we can try a couple experiments, you know, with some of the apps we have. You know, it'd be pretty cool. Thank you again, Chris. Thank you so much. Just say hi to your family for me.
Most definitely. Hold the line while we close things out with the audience, Dennis, while you are online checking out everything from Dennis Stone and America's Stonehenge over at Stonehenge USA, folks. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can go to like, follow, subscribe. We also have a new AI. If you go to CuriousRealm.com/AI, you can ask our chatbot questions, things like that. You can also go to CuriousRealm.com/videos and easily subscribe to all of the videos from our guests. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in, as always. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes a conversation. That is what allows for conversation and for growth of humanity. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit HCUniversalNetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.